Hi, this is Barry Williams. I'm Greg on Paramount Television's The Brady Bunch. All six of us Brady kids.
Maureen McCormick.
Christopher Knight.
Eve Plum.
Mike Lookinland.
Susan Olson.
And me, Barry Williams, have put it all together. We're now the Brady Bunch singing group. We got a sound we hope you'll like. We're sending you the special advance copy, and we hope you'll enjoy it. Ready, gang?
Satan! Satan! Satan!
This is John M. Bennett, and you are listening to 24 Hours of Radio Art on UBC Radio CITR FM 101.9.
On Tuesday, January 17th, UBC Radio, CITR, presents 24 Hours of Radio Art, Plunderphonics, Experimental Music, Cut Up and Collage, Found Sound, Difficult Music, Spoken Word, Noise. Listen live at 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca.
I can't do it. I can't do it.
Well, why not?
I don't know. I just can't. I simply can't.
Mm-hmm.
On Tuesday, January 17th, UBC Radio CITR presents 24 Hours of Radio Art, Thunderphonics, Experimental Music, Cut Up and Collage, Bound Sounds, Difficult Music, Spoken Word, Noise. Listen live on FM 101.9 or online at www.citr.ca.
Why not?
Gobble it all up, so...
Uh-huh.
I can't do it. I can't do it.
Well, why not?
I don't know. I just can't. I simply can't.
Mm-hmm.
Tuesday, January 17th, UBC Radio CITR presents 24 Hours of Radio Art, Thunderphonics, Experimental Music, Cut Up and Collage, Bound Sounds, Difficult Music, Spoken Word, Noise. Listen live on FM 101.9 or online at www.citr.ca.
Why not?
Gobble it all up, so...
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a tennis
player? Today is Friday, January 13th. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to the UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:02 p.m. and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from around Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world.
All this, plus your weekend weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for our local headlines.
A nine-hour standoff, which began around 12:30 a.m. this morning, has ended in arrests, police say. The Vancouver Police Department emergency team responded to a 911 call from inside the 5800 block Knight Street residence. The occupants then refused to leave the house until the police fired off smoke canisters. Three people were brought out of the home and into custody for questioning. There were no injuries. Constable Yana McGuinness said that in the following investigation of the residence, police found evidence of a marijuana grow-op. However, so far, no charges have been laid.
The testimony of Abbotsford gangster Jared Bacon in his cocaine conspiracy trial was dismissed today as a, quote, outright fabrication by prosecutor Maggie Loda. Loda told a judge that the evidence presented showed, quote, beyond doubt, end quote, that Bacon and co-conspirator Wayne Scott are indeed guilty of conspiring to traffic cocaine. Both men have pleaded not guilty to the charges. Bacon reportedly told the court that he lied about his intentions when on the phone with an undercover police officer and that he had really meant to steal up to 100 kilograms of cocaine from a Mexican dealer and not import it to Canada. However, Loda told Supreme Court Associate Chief Justice Austin Cullen this was a lie. His evidence is not worthy of any belief whatsoever, she said. Even if it is believed, both Bacon and Scott are still guilty of the offense, end quote, and that, quote, Bacon and Scott agreed to obtain cocaine for distribution, and that is true whether or not Bacon was going to steal the cocaine, end quote. She wants Bacon's statement to be used against Scott and Scott's to be used against Bacon. Both men's lawyers still claim there is insufficient evidence against their clients to convince them of the charges.
And the First Nations community of Tsawwassen was given the right to govern its reserve and approximately 400 hectares of neighboring property 3 years ago. Now, the chief and council are looking at a proposal to build a 1.8 million square foot shopping complex on the reserve, an area similar to that of Metrotown. Quote, at this point, it's shops, but there is opportunities for entertainment, restaurants, and even potentially a hotel, end quote, Nation CEO Chris Hartman told reporters. The idea is that people who work here will live here and can walk to work, end quote. However, some residents are worried about so much valuable farmland being swallowed up by the massive project, and several band members have questioned how the mall would affect the character of the area. Quote, what we're used to quietness and the birds and the geese and the wildlife, I think that's going to be disrupted completely, end quote, reserve resident Bertha Williams said. Band members will vote on the project next week, and if approved, the construction would begin by the end of this year, to be completed in 2015.
Those are your local headlines. Thank you for being with us. It's now time for the national news.
The federal government announced that legislation will be introduced to repeal the ban on communicating election results while the election is still ongoing. This will effectively legalize what is even now a very common practice on the internet. Quote, our government is committed to bringing Canadian elections into the 21st century by getting rid of this dated and unenforceable law, said Upal, Minister of State for Democratic Reform, in a news release today. Quote, the ban does not make sense with widespread use of social media and modern communications technology, he posted on his Twitter account shortly after the announcement. Canadians should have freedom to communicate about election results without fear of heavy penalty, end quote. The law, Section 329 in the Canadian Elections Act, is specifically meant to prevent the sharing of results with people in ridings who still have ongoing elections, and fines for violating this law can be as high as $25,000. This law was much easier to enforce before the internet became widespread in usage.
In sports news, the Canadian team has won a silver in bobsled and a bronze in skeleton at the World Cup for ski and bobsled taking place in Germany. Olympic champion Kaylee Humphreys of Calgary teamed up with Emily Badzwick of St. Stephen, New Brunswick, to win the silver medal in women's bobsled, while Melissa Hollingsworth claimed bronze in skeleton. Shelley Rudman of Great Britain won the gold in bobsled, while Germany's Marion Thies grabbed hold of the overall World Cup lead from Melissa Hollingsworth after winning the silver in skeleton.
And Canada exploded into international headlines yesterday when attention was refocused on Canada's marriage equality laws and the possibility that same-sex marriages performed in Canada for non-Canadian residents are not recognized in countries where same-sex marriage is not legal. This issue was brought up after a lesbian couple who married in Canada in 2005 tried to get a divorce recently after separating in 2009. However, as one lives in Florida and one lives in the United Kingdom, both of which do not recognize neither the Canadian marriage nor the same-sex marriage in their jurisdiction, they cannot get a divorce with where they are now living. Although the couple is suing the Ontario government for negligent representation, controversy erupted when a government counsel argued that, quote, in order for a marriage to be legally valid under Canadian law, the parties to the marriage must satisfy both the requirements of the place where the marriage is celebrated and the requirements of the law of domicile of the couple with regard to their legal capacity to marry one another, end quote. And for more on this very complex legal and social issue, News 101 spoke to UBC law professor Susan Boyd.
Learning the same-sex non-resident couple has definitely started a media firestorm now that it's become apparent that their case brings up the fact that all non-resident marriages that were performed in Canada are now not valid if the couples now reside in countries that do not recognize same-sex unions. Could you help us clarify the situation so that we can avoid as much as...
That is mostly correct, but I would just add a little bit of nuance to what you said. So the marriages that may not be valid would be those where at least one of the partners, possibly both, had their domicile, that is their permanent residence, in a country that did not recognize same-sex marriage.
Right.
So it is possible, obviously, that some foreign residents may well have come from countries that were recognizing same-sex marriage, like the Netherlands or South Africa or something like that. And if both partners came from such jurisdictions, then the same-sex marriage would very likely be valid. And then in terms of technical legal terms, how you make a valid marriage, say in British Columbia, but really any province in Canada, is twofold. First of all, the parties have to comply with the formalities of solemnizing the marriage in the particular locale. So, for example, in British Columbia, we have something called the Marriage Act, which sets out that you have to obtain a marriage license, you have to have certain type of person marrying you. You know, there's certain rules and regulations, and
yes,
that's all governed by local Canadian and specifically provincial law. And that's not the problem here. The
problem is I believe that's called essential validity.
No, that's formal validity.
That's formal? All right.
So the second thing that is really at issue in this case is what, you're quite right, they call essential validity of marriage. And one of the key aspects of that is whether each partner has the legal capacity to marry the other. And that's where things get tricky, because the legal capacity of each partner to marry is governed by the law in their domicile. And so what the federal government is now saying is that if the law of your domicile says you cannot marry someone of the same sex, then essentially that means even though you came to British Columbia or some other province in Canada and ostensibly got a legal same-sex marriage, it's still not valid. So that's technically where the problem comes from.
Right. And to clarify, is this concerning just same-sex unions, or does it concern straight marriages as well who have come to Canada but now reside in countries outside of Canada?
Yeah, and again, it's not really a question of where they reside now. It's a question of where their domicile was when they got tried to get legally married.
Okay.
So you're quite right. This is a rule that applies to any person trying to get married, whether same sex or a straight couple.
Right.
But obviously, it's got more implications for same-sex couples because so many countries do not recognize same-sex marriage. So it's a bigger problem than, you know, most straight couples are going to encounter.
So could you tell us why the UK, in this case for that couple, did not recognize the couple's marriage in Canada?
So the United Kingdom has decided not to, for now anyway, not to legalize same-sex marriage. And instead what they have done is they've offered an alternative form of relationship to same-sex couples. And what that's called is a civil partnership. And so they introduced legislation called the Civil Partnership Act a few years ago. And so what they're saying is if you're a same-sex couple, you can get civilly partnered, if you like, but you cannot get married. And so what happens is some British couples have come to Canada. They've gotten married, say, in British Columbia, same-sex couples. They've gone back home to the UK, and they've actually there has been a court challenge saying shouldn't our marriage in Canada be recognized as valid in England. And what the tribunals have said so far is that we will recognize your marriage as a civil partnership, but not as a marriage per se. So that's what's happened so far.
Right. And when Prime Minister Stephen Harper was asked this question in a press meet, he said the federal government is not going to reopen this issue. So that clearly tells you a lot about his government's conservative mindset, doesn't it? I mean, what is your opinion on his response?
Mm-hmm. So I actually think what he was saying was that his government has no plans to reopen the issue of legalizing same-sex marriage. Because the case that we're talking about involving people whose domiciles are in foreign countries, that's a particular issue that actually his I think his attorney general has said they will have to probably try to find a way to deal with that. But I think what the Harper government is saying is we are not going to roll back the legalization of same-sex marriage. So for most Canadians who have gotten married in a same-sex partnership, those marriages are still legal so long as they were contracted validly at the time. So I think the Harper government is saying we're not going to revisit the Civil Marriage Act, which is the federal statute that legalized same-sex marriage for Canada.
Yes.
But I also, you know, I also wonder what the government lawyers have been doing getting involved in this case back in Ontario. And it does make you wonder if the two different arms of the government are speaking out of, you know, different sides of the mouth, so to speak.
Exactly. So could you tell us what these lawyers will be doing when the Supreme Court of Ontario will make that ruling later this month?
So So there are two key issues in that case. One is the fact that the government lawyers are saying that this couple who got married several years ago in Canada, but they both had domiciles in countries that did not recognize same-sex marriage, they're saying that their original marriage was invalid. So one partner came from the UK, one partner came from Florida, and neither of those jurisdictions recognized the ability to enter a same-sex marriage. So technically, those two people did not have the legal capacity to get married. And so the government is saying you didn't make a proper marriage at the time because of your lack of capacity to marry. And so now you cannot come and ask for a divorce in Canada because, of course, only married people can actually get a divorce, right?
Right.
That's the whole purpose of divorce, is to unravel the marriage. So that's the first big legal issue that the government lawyers are pressing. And then secondly, to get a divorce in Canada, you actually have to be a resident in Canada for 1 year. And as I understand it, this couple in Ontario has not been resident in Canada for a year. And so the government lawyers are also saying that means they cannot get a divorce.
Right. And when a ruling is made on this issue, what do you think these 5,000 plus people will have to do? Will they have to come back to Canada and go through some sort of legal process to clarify this? That would be quite extensive.
Well, I don't think that's going to be very practical. As I said, I think it's Rob Nicholson. Anyway, one of the government ministers is saying that they realize they need to try to introduce some legislation to at least enable people to get divorces who were, you know, married in Canada under the pretext that their marriage was going to be valid. So maybe we'll see some federal government action to make it possible for people to apply for divorces. But I think the bigger issue is this outstanding question about whether these original marriages were valid or not.
Exactly, yeah.
And I haven't heard anyone from the federal government yet saying that they're going to try to fix that problem. And practically speaking, you know, we do have couples living in Canada who thought that they were validly married under, you know, Canada's laws. Maybe at the time they were not domiciled in Canada, so there is a potential flaw in their in the legality of their marriage. But, you know, they've been living here and assuming that they're legally married. And I'm wondering if the federal government is going to take any steps to fix that problem. I think that's a bigger problem.
Absolutely. And
well, because not everyone's going to get divorced, right?
Right. And of course, a bigger, much bigger issue is, of course, legalizing same-sex marriage across the board,
mm-hmm.
which is something the future will have to deal with.
Yeah, and I mean, I will say, in sort of in defense of the federal government, which I kind of hate to do, but is that this business about individuals having to have the legal capacity to marry and that capacity being determined by the law of their domicile, you know, that's a very deeply embedded law in what we call conflicts of law or private international law. And Canada is not the only country that has that law. And it's not a statute either. It's basically, you know, been built up over the years through case law and so on. And so I actually think the federal government will have to think hard about how they might unravel that aspect of the law, because it's very deeply embedded in many legal systems, not just ours. So I don't quite know how they're going to get around that.
Well, great. Thank you so much, Professor Boyd, for clarifying this for our listeners.
Okay.
And thank you for being on News 101.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Thank you to Professor Susan Boyd from the Faculty of Law at UBC for that interview. Those were your national headlines. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Stay tuned. We play a quick PSA and be right back.
Wednesday, January 18th, from 7 to 9 p.m., the Jewish Museum and Archives of British Columbia will be presenting a Philosopher's Cafe. The topic? Bearing Witness to Witness Testimony, A Skeptic's Approach. Moderated by Ethan Clow, host of CITR's Radio Free Thinker, the evening will be dedicated to a discussion on eyewitness narratives and their relation to the truth, from the point of view of the law to public perception. Everyone is welcome and registration is not required. For more information, please visit jewishmuseum.ca.
Tune in to the 10th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a 14-hour cross-Canada live broadcast on housing and homeless issues. Housing is a right.
There's no excuse why there should be homelessness, and there's no excuse why people should be going hungry in the city of Montreal.
The Homelessness Marathon will be broadcast on over 30 campus community radio stations across Canada. Tune in to your local station from sundown to sunup from February 22nd to the 23rd, 2012. Or go to ckut.ca/homeless to listen online. For more information or to participate, contact marathon@ckut.ca.
I'm here to make it known that all peoples, especially the street peoples and the homeless peoples, have a right to mass media and do have a right to say whatever they feel is right to get themselves into better living conditions.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. Thank you for being with us. It's now time for the international news.
Republican candidate Mitt Romney easily sailed past his opponents to win the second state of the Republican primaries this week in New Hampshire. Compared to his previous victory by 8 votes over opponent Rick Santorum in Iowa, Romney found smooth sailing in New Hampshire, taking 39.3% of the vote. Libertarian Ron Paul had a surprising finish at 22.8%, and in third came former Utah Governor John Huntsman, who was relying on a strong showing such as this to continue his campaign. Although success was expected in the state for Romney, as it is the next-door state to Massachusetts, where he was former governor, the victory has put him in an extremely strong position to win the Republican nomination overall. In his post-victory speech to supporters, Romney pitted himself firmly against President Obama rather than against his fellow Republican candidates, in a move that many saw as an indicator of his expectations of overall success. However, many of his opponents are looking ahead to the next primary, taking place on January 21st in more conservative South Carolina, as the place where Romney will be stopped.
And in other Romney news, the Republican candidate speaks French. A new Gringrich attack ad likens Romney to John Kerry because the two both speak French. Mitt Romney learned French while he was on his Mormon mission in France during the 1960s. Commentators have pointed out that Gringrich actually speaks French himself. He lived in northern France for years as a child. He also cited French books in his bibliography for his PhD in European history. As the South Carolina primary approaches, it's hard to know who you can trust. However, one place to put your vote might be the possibly newly entered candidate, the one and only Stephen Colbert himself, who announced on his television show, The Colbert Report, that he would explore the possibility of running as a Republican presidential hopeful in South Carolina.
Standard & Poor has downgraded France from a AAA rating. The group cited the European Union's inability to manage or even identify the issues of the European debt crisis. They also downgraded the status of 8 other Eurozone countries. Germany's, however, still has its AAA standing. France's finance minister, François Baron, said that the downgrading was not a catastrophe for the country, though the euro dropped to a 16-month low against the dollar when rumors of the downgrade surfaced this morning.
And now to Pakistan, where the Prime Minister has dismissed the country's defense secretary in a move that is likely to heighten existing tensions between the civilian government and the powerful military. Retired Lieutenant General Naeem Khalid Lodi was recently embroiled in a scandal involving an unsigned memo asking for American aid in halting a possible army coup in Pakistan following the killing of Osama bin Laden on Pakistani soil. While the memo is still under investigation, the office of Prime Minister Yousaf Raza Gilani assumes the Lieutenant General of, quote, gross misconduct and illegal action which created misunderstanding between state institutions, end quote. Because of his direct links to the Army High Command, Lodi was seen as having more power than the civilian defense minister. He will be replaced by Narges Sethi, the current cabinet secretary, who was seen as a close ally of Gilani's office. Analysts see the sacking of Lodi as an effort by the government to confront the military, but to do it through the courts rather than risk an armed conflict as has happened in Pakistan in the past.
The U.S. is set to resume diplomatic ties with Myanmar and will be sending an American ambassador to the country for the first time in more than 2 decades. The choice comes after the newly elected democratic government in Myanmar has set into motion a series of political and economic changes, including a ceasefire with the ethnic Karen rebels, with whom there has been conflict since the country's independence in 1948, and the release of political prisoners. In particular, it was announced today that 651 political prisoners, including the leaders of 1988 student protests against the military government, were to be pardoned and released. This reopening of diplomatic ties and the new government's apparent strong commitment to a peaceful and democratic state could help to reshape Asian-American relations as the U.S. seeks to refocus its foreign policy in the region. For more, we go to Free Speech Radio News for their report.
begin to restore diplomatic relations with Myanmar, the Southeast Asian country also known as Burma. The move comes after the country's military-led civilian government released more than 600 political prisoners. In a statement released today, President Barack Obama called it, quote, a substantial step forward for democratic reform. Activists welcome the release of prisoners, but they continue to call for further reform. From Bangkok, FSRN's Ron Corbin reports.
Activists and human rights groups welcomed the Myanmar government's release of more than 650 political prisoners. New York-based Human Rights Watch called the release a crucial step in promoting respect for human rights in Myanmar, also known as Burma. But the organization also called for all remaining political prisoners to be freed immediately. The release covers key members of the 1988 uprising against military rule, including the movement's leaders, Min Ko Nyang, Nila Tien, and her husband, Kien Min Yu, also known as Ko Jimmy, and Te Kwai, Buddhist monk Ushan Gambira, who played a leading role in 2007 protest led by monks, was also released, as well as Shan ethnic leader Kun Tun U. Several reporters working for independent news organizations were also freed. Aung Soar, editor of news magazine The Irrawaddy, says the release was a bold step by President Thein Sein after overcoming resistance within the government.
The president had made a decision several months ago that all will be released. So I think we are hoping that by the end of this year, and all political prisoners should be out of the prison.
Aung Soar, who also fled the 1988 military crackdown, says that after almost three decades of political struggle, Myanmar was heading in the right direction. But Aung Soar says the government has more work to do.
I think the thing is how government going to reach out to the ethnic minorities. And I think that national reconciliation is how to achieve the genuine national reconciliation with all groups, including ethnic minorities and groups, resistance groups, and so that that we could see more stable Burma and a Western government will be convinced to remove and lift the sanctions.
The United States, Europe and Australia have imposed economic, financial and trade sanctions on Myanmar in a bid to press the government toward political reform. After years of little progress, the appointment of President Thein Sein last March following 2010's general elections has marked a new start for Myanmar. Pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi was released from house detention and is now preparing to stand for a seat in parliamentary elections in April. Debbie Stoddard, spokeswoman for the rights group The Alternative ASEAN Network, says the release of the prisoners highlights the success of sanctions against the military establishment to force change.
This is clear evidence that economic sanctions on Burma have worked. The sanctions functioned as a very important bargaining chip to push the authorities to do as they promised that they would. They needed to deliver on their promises. It's very clear from the past few months that the authorities have embarked on a very significant campaign to remove sanctions. And this is part of the campaign.
The release of prisoners included lifting the house arrest of former Prime Minister and Military Intelligence Chief Kin Nhut. The total number of political prisoners behind bars is unclear. The Assistance Association for Political Prisoners Burma, based in Thailand, has put the total at more than 1,000 political detainees still behind bars. Officials and other rights groups say the total figure is lower. Bo Ji, Secretary-General of the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners, called the steps very encouraging, but said many of those released had signed documents warning they could be rearrested later. But Bo Ji was cautiously optimistic.
Anyway, there is really good news for political prisoners, even though they were not recognized as political prisoners by the government.
But Bo Ji says more needs to be done by the government to promote political reform before the international community lifts the economic sanctions.
One of their intentions is to lift sanctions by the United States and European Union, but I think it is not enough just only release of lady political prisoners. They need to improve for the rule of law and other. They need to improve for the human rights violation in Burma. The human rights violation is getting worse and worse, especially in the ethnic areas.
Myanmar is now coming under increasing international diplomatic attention. Several foreign ministers, including U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, have added their support to the program of political reform. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
And a digital privacy advocate named Electronic Frontier Foundation is suing the U.S. Department of Transportation for failing to disclose who is operating military drones within the country and how they are being used in Afghanistan and Pakistan. For more, we go to Free Speech Radio News.
Drones in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and other nations overseas has drawn much criticism for civilian deaths and a lack of accountability. But even less is known about the drones used within U.S. borders. The digital privacy advocate Electronic Frontier Foundation is trying to change that by suing the Department of Transportation for failing to disclose who is operating the drones domestically and how they are being used. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports from Washington.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation submitted a Freedom of Information Act request in April, arguing that the public deserves to know more about the use of drones within the United States. When the FAA failed to release the information after several months, the digital privacy advocacy group filed a lawsuit that may force them to do so. The group says U.S. citizens need to be more informed as the use of this technology expands. According to the Federal Aviation Administration, the government agency charged with regulating the use of these unmanned aircraft, there are about 50 companies, universities, and government organizations developing and producing about 150 different types of drones in the U.S. alone. Such drones can be as big as a commercial aircraft or as small as a hummingbird, and can gather data using cameras, radar, and heat sensors. Drones are used by the Border Patrol to search for undocumented immigrants, and some local agencies have used them for everything from search and rescue operations to tracking natural disasters. The sheriff in Nelson County, North Dakota, has temporarily borrowed drones patrolling the northern border to nail cattle smugglers, and the Miami-Dade County Police purchased a drone with a federal grant.
We could have used it a couple weeks ago. In fact, we had a guy we were chasing, so in a case like that, it could have been used.
That's Dale Patrick with the Queen Anne's County Sheriff's Department. He says the FAA ran drone tests in the county last year and trained staff on how to use one. When the economy turns around, the department may incorporate the technology into their law enforcement toolbox. Civil liberties groups agree that there are many legitimate reasons to use drone technology, but Jay Stanley, a privacy expert with the ACLU, says there are no laws in place to prevent abuse.
There are times when I think most people would say that it's, you know, an unmanned aircraft could be a really good thing, whether there's a child lost in the wilderness and an aircraft can help search for them or what have you. But, you know, we want to be able to get the advantages of this technology without having to worry that somebody's looking at us, following us around every time we walk outside of our front door.
Stanley says the FAA must regulate when, where, and why drones are used.
Most other industrialized countries have privacy commissioners. And in many countries, they have significant powers to enforce the society's privacy norms. And they have overarching privacy laws, which put into place, you know, limits on the amount of surveillance that can be done. So it's really a wild west in this country when it comes to privacy.
The use of domestic drones may expand much more rapidly in the years to come as Congress moves towards finalizing a multi-year FAA reauthorization bill. The most recent version of the legislation calls on the FAA to accelerate the approval of drone use, expand the number of test sites, and draft new rules for both military and non-military deployment. The Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, a drone industry group, spent over $200,000 lobbying Congress in 2011 alone. And several drone conferences scheduled this year to promote the technology are expected to host federal and state agencies. Groups concerned with the unchecked expansion of drone use say an upcoming Supreme Court decision could set a legal precedent for their use and surveillance. In the coming months, the court will rule on whether police departments must get a warrant before using GPS technology to track the movements of a suspect. Stanley says the case raises some big questions about the constitutional right to privacy.
Are we going to update our Constitution and our Fourth Amendment so that it remains relevant in the age of high technology, or is it going to become a dead letter you know, applicable only to our lifestyles insofar as they match the lifestyles of 18th century founding fathers.
Civil liberties groups like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the ACLU say U.S. laws need to keep up with rapidly changing technology to avoid the dangers of becoming a surveillance state. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
It's been 2 years since an earthquake devastated Haiti, and now concern is growing over where to house the earthquake survivors. According to the UN, as many as 1 million people in Haiti are in need of shelter. As temporary shelters are being set up for the homeless, aid organizations are pushing for long-term recovery. For more on this, we go to Free Speech Radio News, who interviewed a DJ at a Haitian radio station.
Is growing over where to house the survivors of the January 12th earthquake. According to the UN, as many as 1 million people, or one out of every 9 residents of Haiti, is in need of shelter. As temporary shelters are being set up for the homeless, aid organizations are pushing for long-term recovery. Oxfam International said in a statement that moving to the temporary camps being set up for the homeless should be voluntary. The aid group also urged officials to create a clear exit strategy for the camps so people can return to their homes. One of those made homeless is radio DJ Coral Pedra. After the quake hit, Pedra was one of the first to send out updates and photos on the social networking sites Twitter and Facebook. Pedra, who is a DJ at the station Radio 1 in Pétionville, spent the next week living in his car and updating listeners through radio broadcasts. Pedra said the station has become a refuge for residents, charging cell phones and reconnecting with loved ones. He spoke to FSRN via Skype.
I'm really happy to be here with you today to speak 2 years later about what happened in Haiti and what the situation is like right now.
We're very glad to have you on the program as well. We first spoke shortly after the earthquake struck in January 2010. And now at that time, you described people who were made homeless by the quake going into your radio station for services, for refuge. What is the area like now where your station is?
Now in Pétionville, we see some changes because most of those people who were living in tents and in public squares in Pétionville were relocated to some other places not long ago. In Pétionville, things seem to be better, but in the main town, the capital of Haiti, Port-au-Prince, that's not the same situation because till now we still have people living in tents in front of the National Palace. We still have other house and rubbles.
You mentioned people still living in tents in front of the National Palace. Housing, of course, is a primary issue now. The UN says that 65% of those in tents in 2010 have been relocated, yet recent UN figures also show that at least 500,000 people remain in tents. What are you hearing about housing from your listeners and those in your community, not just in Pétionville, but in other areas?
Some of them are not really happy because what happened, we all know that the international community made a lot of promises and collect a lot of money for Haiti. And when you hear that Haiti has billions of dollars available for its reconstruction, you would never imagine that 2 years later you would be at that same situation, and even worse, because in October 2010, we had the cholera outbreaks that kills more Haitians and that put them, those people living in very bad sanitation situation, they were more exposed to disease and the situation got worse. So they're not happy about that.
Now, in the rebuilding effort, we're talking about large amounts of money, both government and from NGOs. For example, the American Red Cross raised some $480 million after the earthquake. U.S. Congress allocated $1.14 billion for Haiti last year. From what you can see there on the ground, is this translating into real work, real differences for people living there right now?
No, I don't think so. If we're talking about the relocalization of some people out of tents, yes. But if we're talking about more more reconstruction buildings or other big projects to improve people's lives, there's no signs of that. For example, we don't have an hospital in reconstruction 2 years after. We don't have work going on the ground to provide clean water to people in the capital of Haiti. We don't have anything going on in the countryside with that money collected. That's those kind of questions that we're asking 2 years after.
Coral Pedra, when we spoke in January 2010, you were offering important information to your listeners about food, about shelter, basic information, but you also spoke about the importance of playing music, of keeping the spirit strong. 2 years later now, after the earthquake, how would you describe the mood, the spirit of Haitians, of the people you're speaking with today?
The mood is great. I think that we get the good mood back because we are strong people. But when that day came, you remember where you were, how different it could be. There's so much going on in our minds right now. And January 12th, I don't think will be a happy day for any Haitian who were in Haiti in that special day.
Carol Pedra is a radio DJ with the station Radio 1 in Pétionville, Haiti. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
And thank you to Free Speech Radio News for those headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. I'm Claire Eagle, and you're listening to News 101 on CITR, broadcasting live, CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia.
The UBC Learning Exchange Trek program wants you to get involved in your community. Learn about important social issues, city schools, or nonprofit organizations. You'll also get to meet other UBC students in a fun and supportive environment. See how your talent and skills can make a difference in your community. Participate throughout the term or during reading week. Check out www.learningexchange.ubc.ca/CITR to find out more.
And welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. Now we bring you your weekly weather forecast brought to you by our very own Chirag.
Thank you, Claire. This is your weekend weather forecast. Well, tonight, unfortunately, is going to be cloudy with rain beginning this evening. And if you're unlucky, it might be raining right now. We don't know. We're in a studio. But rain mixed with snow overnight, so watch out for that. Snowfall about 3 centimeters in higher terrain with a low of plus 1. On Saturday, another gray day for you with rain mixed with snow ending in the morning. Then cloudy with 60% chance of rain, rain showers or flurries in the afternoon. With snowfall amount of about 2 centimeters over higher terrain. It would become windy in the morning and continue to do so in the afternoon with a high of plus 5. On Saturday night, don't know where you're headed, but it will be cloudy with a 40% chance of rain showers or flurries in the evening with flurries beginning overnight with a low of minus 1. And Sunday, we'll see some flurries as well, so stay indoors and grab a hot chocolate and just catch up on your homework or something. Well, you'll see a high of plus 3 and a low of minus 1. That was your weekend weather update brought to you by, I guess this is the Weather Network, the Weather Office from Environment Canada.
Perfect. Thanks, Chirag. It's too bad. It looks like we have a pretty gloomy weekend, but at least it won't be raining, hopefully. Maybe snow. Now for some more international headlines, we go back to Free Speech Radio News.
FSRN, U.S. Navy investigators say they have identified the four Marines from a controversial video posted on the internet. The video apparently shows the men urinating on three dead bodies. Investigators told media that the men are part of a sniper division from North Carolina who returned from Afghanistan in September. Today, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton joined the growing chorus condemning the actions of the Marines.
Anyone found to have participated or known about it, having engaged in such conduct, must be held fully accountable.
The Marines involved could be charged with war crimes. Investigators have not released the names of the men. An investigating officer for the Army has recommended a court-martial for Bradley Manning, the soldier accused of releasing hundreds of thousands of classified documents to WikiLeaks. A preliminary hearing on his case was held last month. The recommendation will now go higher up the Army chain of command for a final decision. Manning could face life in prison if convicted. President Obama addressed a group of business owners today at the White House, saying he will elevate the Small Business Administration to a cabinet-level position. He also announced an effort to streamline duplicated government services.
So today I'm calling on Congress to reinstate the authority that past presidents have had to streamline and reform the executive branch. This is the same sort of authority that every business owner has to make sure that his or her company keeps pace with the times. And let me be clear, I will only use this authority for reforms that result in more efficiency, better service, and a leaner government.
As an example of the duplications, he said it is excessive that the Department of Homeland Security reports to more than 100 different congressional panels. Executive branch reform power was first granted during the Great Depression, but then revoked during the Reagan presidency. One of Obama's plans is to consolidate six agencies that deal with small businesses.
In this case, six is not better than one. Sometimes more is better. This is not one of those cases. Because it produces redundancy and inefficiency. With the authority that I'm requesting today, we could consolidate them all into one department with one website, one phone number, one mission, helping American businesses succeed.
The White House is also launching a new website that brings together business information in one place. The Stop Online Piracy Act and the Protect IP Act have sparked outrage around the internet because of vague language and the powers the laws give to internet service providers to police content. Now popular online communities are fighting to get their voices heard. FSRN's Brad Kuttner has the story.
Reddit, an online community and link aggregator that boasts about 2 billion page views a month, will shut down for 12 hours next Wednesday, January 18th. Part of a growing protest, Reddit was urged by its own users to go black and spread awareness about two copyright bills going before Congress, SOPA and PIPA. Opponents say the acts use broad definitions to turn everyday web tools into illegal acts of copyright infringement that could force a website to be shut down or censored. For websites like Reddit, which rely heavily on user-generated content, it could black them out for good. Eric Martin, general manager of Reddit, said the free flow of information that the internet allows would be impossible under the new legislation.
You know, we get billions of page views a day. There's, you know, tens of thousands of people on the site at any given time. It is impossible to sort of filter and police all of that user-generated content for all of these, you know, possible infringements.
The hacktivist group Anonymous has promised to black out their communications in similar fashion. Other websites, such as Google and Facebook, have hinted at taking similar action to spread awareness of the proposed bill. Brad Kuttner, FSRN, Richmond.
Canadian officials have come under international scrutiny after a judge yesterday questioned whether the marriage of a U.S. and British citizen wed in Canada is valid. The judge ruled the couple could not seek a divorce in the country because they were never legally married. But now the federal government is responding, saying it intends to clarify the law to make sure the marriages stand. Today, the government of South Sudan announced nearly 60 people were killed in ethnic violence on Wednesday. Health facilities run by Doctors Without Borders have been destroyed in recent attacks, according to the World Health Organization's Tariq Jasarevic. But now thousands of residents are returning to their homes.
As people are slowly returning to Pibok and Lekwungele, there is a likelihood of increased medical needs since most of them have been in a bush for over a week. Most of the patients evacuated in the last 3 days were wounded 5 days ago and have been in hiding for safety reasons.
Violence between two cattle-raising tribes erupted again in late December. It's estimated that as many as 3,000 people have been killed so far and 60,000 residents have been displaced. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
And thanks, as always, to Free Speech Radio News for that. Further headlines and their full newscast can be found at fsrn.org.
And that's our program for Friday, the 13th of January. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. Today's show was produced for us by the wonderful Morgan Yee. And from the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned now for Stranded at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM.